From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them.
Republicans search for their leader. Democrats look for a new gun control plan. The U.S. ends a training program for Syrian rebels as Russia fires cruise missiles. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm your guest host, Todd Purdom, senior writer at Politico and contributing editor at Vanity Fair. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com. And on the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Welcome to you both. So, guys, this week the House Republicans had a shocking denouement to the speaker's race. It's not over yet. But, Rich, you guys at National Review suggested, does this mean that the House of Representatives is ungovernable, unmanageable? What's going to happen?
Well, it was shocking. Everyone assumed that Kevin McCarthy was outgoing Speaker John Boehner's natural successor, but he ran into this problem, which bedeviled Boehner throughout his speakership, which is that he could hold a majority of the Republican conference. If there had actually been a vote within the conference, he might have gotten 190, even 200 votes. But to become speaker, you need a vote on the floor to get 218. And that empowers 40 or so Republicans on the right who are implacably opposed to the leadership, were opposed to McCarthy, didn't like the idea of going to all the trouble of ousting Boehner only to give the second in line a promotion. And McCarthy apparently just made the calculation that he wasn't going to get to 218, or getting to 218 would require making concessions that would make his life miserable as speaker. So he made this shocking announcement before the conference that he was stepping down. Now there's a major lobbying campaign going on to enlist Paul Ryan, who has studiously and consistently said he is not interested in the speakership, to run as seemingly the only figure, at least the only obvious one, that can unite the conference to get to 218. And so all Republicans in Washington are in pins and needles waiting to see what Paul Ryan says.
So, Bob, what happens next? Can a fresh face? Why is a fresh face going to solve this problem that Rich just outlined with the Republican caucus? How can a new face by itself get the kind of support any leader would need?
Well, it won't. I mean, the contradiction in the Republican Party, it's different than the one in the Democratic Party. In the Democratic Party, people on the left do want government. They just want government to serve the people rather than the banks. And the Democratic Party leadership wants to serve the banks and big corporations and big contributors and not the people. But they both want government. The problem in the Republican Party is the populist sentiment has been distorted to say we're just against government. Government is the problem. But the fact is the wealthy people who basically the party has served, the GOP has served, want government. They want government to do trade agreements. They want government to spend on the military. They want tax breaks from the government. And also ordinary folks want government to send checks, Social Security and what have you. So they're concerned about government functioning. The problem that the party has, and I don't think it's restricted to a small angry group of Tea Party legislators, I think they're responding to a base that is unhappy, as is the base of the Democratic Party, with the way the economy is working, with the way the country is going. They're not happy campers, and they're not buying the rhetoric anymore. Oh, we're against big government. Well, no, you are big government. You control the House. Now deliver to us. And I think the Republican Party is a party without a program that can contain both the super wealthy and the suffering middle class and working class.
Rich, we now hear all sorts of wild scenarios. An interim caretaker speaker, someone like maybe John Klein from Minnesota, who's announced his impending retirement. Even the idea of a former member or a non-member, which under the Constitution, I guess, is possible. What is the likelihood of that? What do you think is really the most likely scenario? John Boehner just serving through the end of 2016?
It seems very unlikely that you have 247 very ambitious people are going to let someone else come in and take this plum constitutional office. And this is being played as an enormous crisis, but this is in part how Democratic politics looks in a free, pluralistic, rambunctious society. I suspect Boehner will stay there until there is a successor. And if it's not Paul Ryan, eventually someone will have the credibility and creativity to get to 218. And the longer this drags on, the longer you will have just sheer exhaustion setting in, which would aid someone eventually getting over the finish line. Because they do, one way or the other, have to have a speaker.
And Bob, you mentioned that ordinary people do want government. They want the parks to function. They want the basic functions of government. How much more likely does this chaos make a government shutdown in the future, or failure to raise the debt ceiling, both of which have to happen in the next few weeks?
Look, first of all, just speaking for myself, there are lots of things government does that I would like to see shut down. I think we waste an awful lot, you know, on the cracking down on drug addicts, and we waste an awful lot on unneeded wars, and we waste an awful lot on bailing out corporations that don't pay their share of taxes and stash their money abroad. So, you know, there's lots of room for cutting back government. But yes, government provides on both the federal and the local level indispensable services. That's why we have government. The problem the Republicans, and I think Rich should address this, the problem Republicans have is that they have played a very simple scapegoating game against the very idea of government. That has been the way you get a party that seems to be for the oppressed masses and at the same time more slavishly serves the big business interests than the Democrats do. That's been the contradiction in the Republican Party, particularly since Reagan. You're supposed to be for the average suffering taxpayer, and yet you're also with the big banks and corporations that don't pay their fair share of taxes and that lay off those long-suffering workers and outsource their jobs. So the Republican Party really has an ideological conflict that they can't paper over, and the revolt of those 30, 40 dissidents each time is an expression of rage at the base.
What do you say to that, Ridge?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. On first blush, it's really mostly about tactics rather than ideology. If you're going to give a political philosophy test to any given member of the House Freedom Caucus, the right of the caucus, those 40 members we mentioned earlier, and John Boehner, they would probably agree on 9 out of 10 basic questions about what the appropriate role of government is. But those 40 members are sick of leadership. They think leadership constantly sells out. They think leadership isn't aggressive enough. They think Republicans could have won these various shutdown of fiscal confrontations with Obama, at least gotten better deals if they'd been harder edged. So it's largely a tactical dispute, but there is a kind of an elite populist element to it as well, where they think the Republican leadership is too close to K Street and to lobbyists. And this aspect of the dispute, I think, or the fissure within the Republican Party, is more starkly exemplified by Donald Trump, who's really not a conservative at all, who is a populist through and through. And he is the one who's really expressing that point of view. But Bob is absolutely right in the fact that the conservative base and the grassroots is completely sick and tired of its own leadership. And that's been driving events on Capitol Hill and has been driving events in the presidential race as well.
Just one quick question before the break. I spent some time looking at Kevin McCarthy's background this week, growing up in Bakersfield, his roots in the Central Valley of California. By any conventional measure, he's 99 and 44 100% conservative. How conservative do you have to be to pass muster with a Freedom Caucus of the House? Senator Al Simpson of Wyoming used to talk about saliva tests. It seems that's the world we're living in.
Well, it's their definition goes to these tactical issues, because the way I look at it, I would say, you know, Kevin McCarthy, if you want to take him, and the average member of the Freedom Caucus are equally conservative. They just have different views of the means towards the end that you can realistically deploy. A lot of these members of the Freedom Caucus would say, no, it's actually these tactical matters speak to your sincerity and your core beliefs. So if you disagree with us on these tactical matters, if you consider yourself, quote unquote, more realistic, it's really that you're not fully committed and you're not a conservative. And, you know, that's an argument that's been going on for years now on the Hill.
Let us know what you think about leadership in the House at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, considering new gun control measures. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Todd Purdom of Politico and Vanity Fair. On the left today is Robert Scheer, author of the book They Know Everything About You. And on the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Bob, this week Hillary Clinton put out both a basic plan for some stricter gun control measures and her own take on how she would deal with the financial regulation and big banks. She stands on both fronts in contrast to her liberal rival, Bernie Sanders of Vermont. What do you make of Secretary Clinton's approach to these issues, and where do things stand in the Democratic primary on those issues?
Well, I don't know if I want to go too far on Hillary. I'm trying to be objective. But, I've met the woman, as you have. I've covered her. And I know she's bright. I know she professes concern for people. Going back to her youth as a Goldwater Republican and now as a New York Democrat.
I feel a big butt coming on here, Bob.
No, I really just don't get it, you know, frankly. I mean, she gave the thing you're referring to on the finance, it's called My Plan to Prevent the Next Crash, Bloomberg View. And one thing she does is she blames it all on George W. Bush. It all came out of nowhere. It was all 2008.
Nothing but the Glass-Steagall Act of husband.
Well, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of her husband when he was a lame duck, saying that no collateralized debt obligations or credit default swaps could be covered by any existing regulatory agency or any law. So they gave that's where the gates to greed were opened. And it was done, you know, the Republicans couldn't do it on their own. Ronald Reagan faced the savings and loan scandal. So at the end of his administration, he actually tightened financial regulation. It remained with the triangulation of Bill Clinton to come in and make an alliance with Phil Graham on the Senate side and say, no, let's get rid of all this and let's modernize by deregulating. Now, Hillary Clinton gives a piece to the Bloomberg, her new economic plan, and says, no, she's not going to join Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and, by the way, John McCain in calling for restoring Glass-Steagall. And she's going to just a little tighten Dodd-Frank a little bit, but we know she's carried water for Wall Street. She's been received enormous amount of money from Wall Street as her husband, as their family foundation, and so she's in the pocket of Wall Street and no populist by any stretch of the imagination.
And Rich, how about guns? Hillary Clinton wants to tighten regulations at gun shows. She wants to make large volume dealers there by executive action subject to the same kinds of things as if they were regular arms dealers, gun merchants. She has a different approach than Bernie Sanders, who's a gun rights advocate from Vermont. What do you make of that battle between the two of those? Is that something that's going to get any traction in the Democratic fight?
Yeah, I think the politics for her within the Democratic primary are very good because it's an awkward situation for Bernie Sanders coming from a very pro-gun state in Vermont and having a relatively moderate record on guns over the years. I don't think her proposals make any sense whatsoever. Reinstituting the assault weapons ban, which lapsed after 10 years when everyone realized it was a completely meaningless symbolic gesture that did nothing to reduce crime. If you look at gun homicides in the United States, there are about 300 committed a year with all rifles, let alone assault rifles, which isn't even tracked because it's such a minute number. And she's also relying or playing on this myth that there's a gun show loophole where actually if you're a federally licensed dealer and you sell at a gun show, you have to do background checks and conduct your business just as if you were selling anywhere else. So these are all really minor symbolic measures that fulfill the understandable reflex to do something after these horrible tragedies. But in a country with 300 million guns, all this stuff will be ineffectual.
Isn't the bottom line, Bob, that with Congress in this current state, nothing's really going to happen on guns anytime in the near future?
No, I don't agree with that. I think we are seeing a major shift in thinking about guns and violence, and it's dawned on people, after all, as we go to air today. I mean, there's gun violence is in northern Arizona. And, you know, it affects rural communities. It affects communities of irrespective of race and background. And we are the most violent culture in the world. And we have a disproportionate faith in guns as a means of security and as a means of asserting one's rights and protecting one's freedom. And it's absurdly out of joint with where the rest of the world is, and certainly the more developed world. And I think there's a recognition that we have too many guns, and we can argue about, you know, the specifics of this weapon or how you get the law changed or how you enforce it. But I think Bernie Sanders better very quickly come out with a tougher position on guns, you know. And I understand why, coming from a more rural area like Vermont, there was pressure on him, just as the pressure on Hillary from the Wall Street banks. But the fact is, these people, being politicians, have to provide leadership. And we, you know, that figure of the 300 million weapons that are not needed for anybody's security tells you the story. We have to get rid of them, and we have to get rid of them fairly rapidly and in ways that also bring in measures of security for Americans so they don't feel they need to rely on this primitive means of asserting their rights. It's bizarrely out of joint with the modern age.
Finally, the U.S. ends a program that was meant to train Syrian rebels to fight against the Islamic State, even as Russia steps up its own intervention in Syria. Rich, what's going on in Syria? Sometimes it seems like the headlines are a flashback to the Cold War, and we're having a proxy war with Russia over the whole situation. Unpack the latest developments there for us.
Well, there are a couple of big things going on. One, Vladimir Putin is humiliating the President of the United States and enjoying every single minute of it. And two, this is a strategic and ideological play. He wants to buttress authoritarian governments around the world to the extent he can and gain a foothold in the Middle East, cement an alliance with Syria and Iran, and gain a foothold in the Eastern Mediterranean that allows him to harass and harry NATO's southern flank in the form of Turkey, which we've already seen with the incursions into Turkish airspace over the last few days. And I think that the bigger play here is that Putin would love to defang NATO and demonstrate its complete ineffectiveness by really pushing the envelope, probably not in Turkey, but in the Baltic states, and that's something, unfortunately, we have to look forward to in the next year.
Bob, the Pentagon has announced it's abandoning its own plan to train Syrian rebels, which has obviously not been very successful. What are the realistic options going forward for the Obama administration in the United States in this conflict?
Well, they should read Graham Greene and Quiet American and understand the danger of thinking you're going to order the whole world, that you know what's best for people, that your motives are always fine. We've been led around by the nose by Saudi Arabia in the Mideast. We've gotten rid of dictators when the Saudi monarchy, which is the most oppressive regime, maybe certainly in that part of the world, certainly one of the most oppressive in the world, responsible really for not monitoring the financing of al-Qaeda. So we've had this madness going back to our original, if you want to bring the Russians into it, our original intervention in Afghanistan, where we recruited people, including bin Laden, when they were on our side as great freedom fighters. And so this whole madness that's occurred is really something that we sponsored. And Hillary Clinton, for example, and the Obama administration, yes, they opened the door by destabilizing Libya and Syria, and which followed in the steps of George W. Bush doing that in Iraq. And the problem for our position, the U.S. position, is that we seem to be on the side of the religious fanatics, tactics. And what Putin has been able to do is say, hey, these other guys may be dictators, but they're secular dictators. They're not involved with Saudi Arabia. We face Muslim fanatics in Chechnya. We're familiar with this. And so, yes, we're going to line up with Assad in Syria, and we're going to be a bit friendlier, some other forces in that area. And you claim you've got free Syria people. But the fact is, you've got a split off from al-Qaeda, and you've got an actual unit of al-Qaeda are the main fighting forces to topple Assad. And as we've seen in Libya, when you get rid of a Gaddafi, you get something worse.
In just about a minute, Rich, what's going to come next? What should we be expecting in the hard to predict?
Well, it seems though we'll likely do not much or nothing at all, and Putin will continue his campaign with Assad to crush the non-ISIS rebels as part of Assad's broader strategy to confront the rest of the world with the choice between him and the radical extremists. A very cynical game, but one that unfortunately has some chance of success.
Let us know what you think about Syria at kcrw.com/LRC. Bob, should the Obama administration have seen this coming? Should they have foreseen that Putin was going to fire cruise missiles into Syria? Is this something that we should have anticipated?
Well, first of all, this demonization of Putin, I think, is really nutty myself. This doesn't mean you have to celebrate Putin, but first of all, he has tremendous support in his own country, and it's not because he's a dictator or something. I mean, there's what he does is manipulate public opinion with abandon. So do our leaders and so do people elsewhere in the world. But the fact is, he's responding to some genuine nationalist feelings in Russia that the fall of communism did not bring a version of capitalism and nationalism that made people's lives better. A lot of their resources were ripped off. You had a lot of hustlers go and make deals and make themselves into billionaires, and they have their yachts parked in Santa Monica Bay. He has a base of support. But what he's also asserting is, wait a minute, we still have this big military arsenal. We can fire, missiles 1,000 miles away. We can do the same game. We can do the air war. And he's put the Obama administration in a very bad position. I'm not saying this is good for the Syrian people to be ripped apart by two, powers. It's very bad for the Syrian people. It creates refugees. It's a horrible human rights situation. But where did the United States say we have a monopoly on creating mischief and turmoil in this world? We've been doing it with abandon. Here comes Putin, and he is holding the better hand, which we have not addressed. He is on the side of a secular dictator. We are on the side of religious fanatics in Saudi Arabia, and who are supporting their compatriots in Syria, like-minded people. So the fact of the matter is, it's an enormous embarrassment for the United States, because we actually seem to be determinedly on the wrong side of history. We're supporting madness in that part of the world.
Rich, what are the realistic options for the United States going forward? I mean, Hillary Clinton wants a no-fly zone. Is that going to work in this current climate?
I think Russia has basically made the no-fly zone not an option. I do think we should be doing as much as we can reasonably to buttress the non-ISIS forces. Again, the gains that the non-ISIS rebels were making in the north was the immediate precipitating event for this intervention to try to save Assad. And our arm and train program has been a complete disaster for reasons that were outlined in an excellent and very exhaustive Wall Street Journal article this week. But the basic problem is, if you recruit people and tell them they can only fight ISIS and not fight Assad, you're not going to get anyone to do that. So this is, in effect, a proxy war, and we should support what moderate rebels there are there on the ground. And Bob is absolutely right about Putin's strength at home, but it helps a lot to be able to jail your opponents and to nod and wink at your allies shooting down journalists in the street. And he has stoked these nationalist fires by invading, for instance, a peaceable country, Ukraine, and annexing its territory in a way we haven't seen in Europe in decades and decades and decades. So he is, Putin, obviously, healing, to some extent, the psychic wounds of the Russian people after the catastrophic failure of state socialism and communism under the Soviet Union. But this isn't really a great way to do it. And the story in Syria is basically Western passivity. We didn't tear Syria apart. We stood aside while it fell apart. It's been a humanitarian and a strategic catastrophe.
Bob, you wanted to respond to Rich?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely correct that Putin is not a progressive leader. In fact, my concern about Putin is he's more a little bit like Donald Trump or someone, or maybe the Republican right in America. He's cozied up to the Russian Orthodox Church. He's condemned gay people. He is not at all sensitive to a grassroots participation in the political system and economy. He cozies up to billionaires. He is a believer in crony capitalism. So I'm hardly offering Putin as a model. But the problem is he's on the right side of saying the biggest problem in, if you're concerned about religious-inspired terrorism, it's Saudi Arabia. And we are on the wrong side of the Saudi question in the Middle East. And Putin has been able to move in and exploit the fact by at least saying, yes, a secular dictator is better than a religious fanatic.
To compare Vladimir Putin to the right in America is completely ridiculous. I mean, conservatives in this country revere the Constitution. They want more than anything else limited government. And they got this great burst of energy from exactly the sort of grassroots activism that Bob alludes to, which was called the Tea Party. So that's really just a foolish smear, I'm afraid.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob Scheer, it's your soapbox.
Yeah, I think it's time for Democrats to question being ready for Hillary. I think we don't need another Clinton and we don't need another Bush. And I'm saying that only because if you don't have a progressive populism coming from the left, you're going to have a reactionary populism coming from the right. That is the seed of fascism, if you will. If you can't address the needs that people have in this country for decent jobs, a decent standard of living, their fear of jobs leaving, and high taxes, and you got a Donald Trump on one hand, and the Democrats can't come up with an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders, or anyone who doesn't want to continue playing up to Wall Street, there isn't going to be a good choice in this election.
Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
The NHL season just started, and offensively challenged teams might want to consider signing up a scoring phenom out of Russia named Vladimir Putin, who in an exhibition game held on his birthday scored an astonishing 7 goals. Gretzky or Lemieux didn't have anything on this guy in their primes. Of course, it helps a lot if the opposing goalie is scared to death of you, literally.
For my rant, it's Kevin McCarthy and Nancy Pelosi. They're the two most important Californians in Washington. They have no relationship. They don't work together. They do nothing really to support each other or the interests of their state. And I think that's a corollary to the sad state of affairs in the Republican caucus. These two people ought to be able to work together on behalf of the state they both purport to serve. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Robert Scheer and Rich Lowry. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. And I'm Todd Purdom of Vanity Fair and Politico. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Oh, so if you like pajamas,
pajamas.
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we
know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.